And welcome to the day two. So let's, yesterday, although I introduced Riemann surfaces, there are several terminology that needs to be introduced. And the first one is branch point. So branch points are points on the Riemann surface, so on the complex plane, such that if you go around them in a small circle, the function shows multi-valuedness. Okay? So what we say is that the function has monodromy around a branch point. So given a function, the branch points are a property of the function. However, there'll be branch cuts associated with these branch points. They will be connected by branch cuts. So the branch cuts are the surgeries that, they are the lines that you do by doing surgery on the complex manifold, in order to extend the domain of the function such that the function is single-valued on the extended domain. The position of the branch cuts will depend on how you parameterize your function. In particular, it'll depend on the polar coordinate that you use for your function. So for example, in the example that we are looking at, which is square root of z, we have square root of r e to the power I theta by 2. Now if you choose the range of theta to go from 0 to 2 pi, then the branch cut will lie on the positive real axis. But if you had chosen your theta to go from, say, minus pi to plus pi, then the branch cut would have the branch cut would have been on the negative real axis. So this is a very simple example. All the complicated examples that we saw yesterday just follow, and you can move the branch cuts around by, you know, choosing the polar coordinate. So today, we'll actually get into the analysis part of complex analysis.
So branch cuts always extend from, they always extend from the branch point to infinity?
No. They extend from one branch point to another branch point. It may be that the function that you're looking at has a branch point and infinity. In that case, you know, there will be a branch cut from the finite part of the complex plane to infinity. So in yesterday's example, the last example we had where it was square root with four factors inside, that function didn't have a branch point at infinity.
That's true.
There were four branch points, but they were all, you know, near the origin. So there's a way of choosing the parameterization. For example, you could have chosen the parameterization in a way such that these two are connected like this, and these two are connected in such a way that the branch cuts go off to infinity and they join up at infinity. But there is no branch point in infinity. Right? If you choose the angle for this one to be like this, and the angle for this to be like that, this is what you would get, right? There was a branch point at plus one and minus one.
Yeah.
So when we were expanding around this, you would have there was a factor which was associated with this branch point in that function. when you expanded that, if you use a polar coordinate there, if you set the range of that polar coordinate to go from 0 to 2 pi, and the range of the polar coordinate for this guy to go from minus pi to plus pi, then this is the kind of branch cut you would get. And that would mean that they actually join up in infinity. Because our function was like this. Now, if you look at this for large values, you see that this is, you know, this doesn't have a branch point in infinity, right? Okay? So, you can do transformations of your Riemann surface. Yes?
Is it possible to have an odd number of branch points?
Yes. And that's the example that we had, the second example, which had a branch point at the origin, and a branch point at 1, and a branch point at infinity. And so there's another notion called the order of a branch point. That is how many times you have to go around a branch point to get back to the same value of the function. So if you look at that, the solutions are on the tutorial, on the wiki. If you look at that, you'll see that this is a second order branch point. This is a second order branch point. The branch point at infinity is a fourth order branch point.
Is it fourth?
Order branch point. So the function was, right? So for large, you know, values of z, this becomes, has this kind of, so you see that to go around infinity, you'll have to actually, you know, go around 4 times to get back to the same value. All right? Okay, so today's topic is complex functions and their properties. There are many ways of defining a complex function. Okay, let's just, the formal definition of a complex function is that suppose you have an open subset of the complex plane, then a complex function is a map from this open set onto the complex plane. So various ways of defining complex functions. One is you can define them very explicitly. So for example, you know, this is a complex function. So this is defined in all of the complex plane except the origin where it blows up. So you can think of a complex function as being composed of two real functions, right? So this is my complex variable. So I can write it as in terms of two real variables. Similarly, the complex function that you're considering. Sorry, I'm writing f as a function of z, not z bar. Out of force of habit, in principle, a complex function can be a function of z bar too. So let's just, for once, write it like that. Although those are not the complex function we will be interested in. So, you know, a general complex. And I'll very soon I'll tell you why this is so. So this can be seen as u, which is a real function of x and y, plus v, which is a real function of x and y. So a complex function can be thought of in terms of two real functions. Okay. Now, because, you know, so this implies z bar is x minus iy. The relationship between xy and z bar are linear. So if we have, you know, so we can think of the function f as a function of x and y or z and z bar, right? And that's why I wrote this. So let me give you some examples of complex function as functions of z and z bar. So for example, this is a valid complex function. But if you want to write it in terms of z and z bar, then you have to do this, right? So however, there will be functions which can be expressed exclusively in terms as functions of z. So for example, we'll soon see, you know, this function right. So functions, complex functions which are just functions of z, they are called holomorphic functions, and they have a very central role to play in the subject of complex analysis. And why that is so, you know, we'll come to that momentarily in our lecture. But aside from that, this involves another way of defining complex function, where you take a well-known real function, so for example, the exponential, you know, the cosine of x, and you extend that function to the whole of the complex plane. So that's another way of generating complex functions. You're given, say, sine of x or cos of x or tan of x, and you just let x become, take values on the complex plane. And that technique of defining a complex function is called analytic continuation. Yeah, so. And you might say, what's the big deal about analytic continuation? The deal about analytic continuation is that when the complex when the function that you're extending is holomorphic, that only depends on z, and you're letting it extend from the real line to all of the complex plane, the fact that it's holomorphic assures you that there's a unique continuation of that function, right? Because a real function, in principle, can be continued to the complex plane in more than one way, right? But if you impose that it's actually holomorphic, then there's a unique extension. Okay, let's give a few more examples of complex functions. In some sense, this is a very unsatisfactory course because I throw out all these statements and prove all nothing. So, but that's the way things are. I wouldn't be able to prove most of these statements myself. So, but kind of give you a feel for it. So, you know, we already saw sine and cosine. So, well, sine has a minus sign here, right? So this is our familiar expression for sine, where we are treating x as a variable that takes value on the real line. So instead of x being on the circle, from 0 to 2 pi, we are allowing it to go from minus infinity to plus infinity, right? And I'm thinking. Right. So if, for example, just bear with me, if I had defined something like this, So if I had defined something like this, so not a holomorphic function, and I said that, okay, if I allowed, right, if I take Z to be, say, real, but say within, you know, allowed between 2 pi and 0, right? Then within that limited range, I could identify this as a sine of theta, right? And, but if we now, so okay, I'm kind of trying to sort of, you know, come up with an example where, you know, where the extension of a function defined on a circle, when it's extended to the complex plane, has a non-holomorphic extension. Okay. So anyway, let's. This is kind of bizarre. I just wanted to kind of, you know, give some impromptu sort of you know, evidence for the statement that. That if we don't impose the fact that we are doing an analytic, we have a holomorphic function, and therefore we are doing an analytic continuation, then you have more than one choice of extending a function beyond the limited range that it was first defined on. So, but I haven't thought about it very carefully, so. Okay, so we all, so, and you know, there's a similar formula for cos and with 2, and you know, these guys we can extend to the complex plane just by replacing x by z. Similarly, so these guys, so, okay, one of the things you want to do when you're extending a real function analytically to the complex plane is when you project down to the real plane, you want that function to have the same behavior as your real function. And here you can see that this function is still periodic on the real line, but it actually, all the zeros of this function you can verify are actually on the real line. So there are no zeros on the imaginary axis. And it coincides with this function on the real line. And why I'm saying so is sometimes you will have a choice when we look at when you look at multivalued function, when you do the analytic extension of those guys. Well, when you do an analytic extension of a real function and you get a multivalued function, you'll have a choice of putting the branch cut. And the way you should choose your branch cut such that when you actually you shouldn't, but you know, you have the choice. If you want to get your familiar function when you project down to the real line, then you have to choose your branch cut in such a way that, you know, it doesn't fall within the range that you usually had of the real function. Anyway, so the sine hyperbolic and the cos hyperbolic are given similarly. And these functions are now, they're oscillatory on the imaginary axis. So if you just put z equals to x plus iy, you will see that x e to the power iy can be decomposed in terms of cosines and sines using the Euler formula, and therefore you see that on the imaginary axis, this is going to be an oscillatory function. So inverse functions we've already seen some inverse functions. We've seen this guy. And this is the inverse of this guy, and log of z, that's the inverse of this thing. So yesterday we defined square root of z on the Riemann surface, but for a lot of computations you don't have to do that. You can introduce what is known as a cut plane. So square root of z is a single valued function except on the positive real axis, right? So what you can do is that you can take the positive real axis, sorry, you can take the complex plane and remove the positive real axis. And then that object is called the cut plane. And the square root of z is a single valued function on the cut plane. And for a lot of calculations, that is actually sufficient. Especially when you're doing some integrals using complex analysis, contour integrals, the cut plane becomes very useful. And we'll see examples of using the cut plane in the fourth lecture and perhaps in the last tutorial. The fourth lecture will be dedicated to computing integrals, you know, because that's just how you always have to do that in complex analysis. Otherwise, you know, it's customary to do that, let's just say. Okay? So the log function is the real part.
I'm not sure why. Why do you focus on the positive real axis for your?
It's just convenience. You could have chosen the parameterization of z in such a way that it could be. You could have taken out the negative real axis. You can do that. Yeah.
So what defines this cut? It's like your branch cut, but you just.
Right. So you did. All I'm saying is that this function is. It's multi-valued on the complex plane,
but
it's single-valued on the cut plane. That's all I'm saying. And for a lot of cases, all you need is the cut plane. So you know there will be
position to what the whole tower of Riemann surfaces.
Well, not tower. There are only two. Yeah. So for example, you know, at some point we'll do some integral which will involve. Doing a path integral.
Yeah.
By path integral, I mean contour integral. You know, on the cut plane, which will go like this. Right? It'll you know, these are tricks that we will use, and it will just bear with me. You know, there will be a theorem on the fourth lecture, where we'll use the cut plane to do some very fancy integrals. So. No. So it just, you know, for now just think that this function is single valued on the cut plane. Right? Because you know, this guy has over on this edge it has the value of square root of r. On this edge it has the value of minus square root of r. If you had, you know, chosen your cut plane to be here, there would probably be an I or something. Or no. Anyway, it'll have, but the thing is that the two values would be flipped by a sign, right? Whereas if we did include this positive real axis, then, you know, well, these are values that they approach, right? Then the value of the function on this real axis you'd have two values, right? So, I mean, yeah, there's nothing deep about it. I'm just like doing surgery to make something well defined. So okay, coming back to the log function. So the arg of z, that's a multivalued function. So it involves the principal value of the argument times 2 pi an integer. And so here we have an infinite tower of infinite number of values of this function. Now, when we define inverse functions such as sine inverse, stuff like that, we have to take, you know, log. So these functions these functions inherit the infinite sheeted, the structure that the log function has. And you might wonder, does this also have a branch point at z equals to 1? And you can show that it doesn't, that that point, it's a statement. Sorry, I forget the statement here. Hang on. No, I think it's the other way around. If you'd expect that, like the log function, which has a branch point at z equals to 0, that this will have a branch point when the argument of the log goes to 0, right? So if you do that, if you say, OK, then let's find that out. So where is the infinitely sheeted, where is the branch point, you know, which has infinite branch? So we have to find this out, right? So then you find that this is right. So that means that it doesn't have a branch point which has infinite number of the of infinite order. So the branch point is really at this point. It's a double sheeted Riemann surface.
So does that inherit the infinite sheet?
No, it doesn't, because for it to have an infinite number of a branch point of infinite order, like the logarithmic branch point, the argument of the log function has to vanish, right? There's an I here, right? So I think I made a mistake here. Can we have solutions here?
Set square, like, yeah, 2 set square equals 1.
2, okay. Hang on, just a.
Because of the second line, it's wrong.
Right, okay, so sorry. I'm looking at the wrong example, that's why. Sorry. Completely messed that up, sorry. I was looking at this example. I was wanting to discuss this example. Which was sine hyperbolic of z. Right. So that's what happens. So for this example, if you say, OK, if I set this equals to 0, right, then we have, this also does, right? Then we have 2. Z squared minus 1, then z squared is.
I'm not sure about that. There's no minus there.
there?
Sorry?
With the square of both sides.
No, when you take this on the other side, you get a minus sign, right? So.
But you square it.
But then you square it.
Oh, okay, yeah, sorry. So yeah, clearly I can't do algebra. So yeah, sorry. Right, so. And I think in this, I made the same mistake in the yeah. previous. So there, so yeah, so yeah. Sorry, I got confused. So, okay, coming back, this thing has a branch point at z equals, you know, at z equals to plus 1 and minus 1. But it doesn't have a branch point at z. You know, those are branch points which are second order branch points. But there is no branch point which is of infinite order. That's the point I wanted to make. Because you'd think that a function which has a log in it would have an infinite order branch point, right? But for that to happen, the argument, you know, if we look at this function, you know, where is the branch point for this guy? It's when the argument of the log goes to zero, right? So over here, for this to have an infinite order branch point, you know, this argument has to go to zero. And all I'm saying is that on the complex plane, on the z plane, the argument does not, you know, the argument never goes to zero, okay? But this square root means that at z equals to, you know, plus minus I, there could be a branch point, okay? There is an exercise, I won't go through it, where given the definition of the sine and the cosine or the cosh or the sinj or cosh, you can actually find these expressions. It's just a few lines of algebra. And because I want to move on to the notion of complex differentiability. Of differentiability for a complex variable is a much stronger notion than the notion of differentiability for real functions. So let's remind ourselves what differentiability means for a real function. So let's take a real function of x and y, and we say that this function is differentiable at the point x naught and y naught, if there exist, if for two small real numbers h and k, we can extend this in such a way that there exist two numbers a and b, and a remainder function. Now, such that for h naught and k naught in a small neighborhood of that the remainder function, when divided by the this might look, I'm going to raise this so you can see it. Okay, this might look a little weird, a bit, but the reason why I'm defining it like this is because we are considering a function of two variables, right? When we are defining the derivative of a function of a real of a single variable, you know, it's much easier. You just say, okay, we have x plus h minus f of x divided by h, where limit of h goes to 0, right? So this is the multi-variable version of that condition. So if A and B exist, then so you know we say that you know the function is differentiable at that point x naught and y naught. And similarly for V, we can write the same formula. But these constants do not have to be the same. And there could be a different remainder function, of course. But the condition is that the remainder function needs to go to 0. So just put s square root of h squared plus k squared. This goes to 0 as h and k go to 0. So if A, B, C, and D exist, then we say that A is the partial derivative of U with respect to X, and B is the partial derivative of U with respect to Y at point X naught and Y naught, and C is the partial derivative of V respect to x, and similarly, d is the partial derivative at y. So this is all good. Now we want to extend this to the that's broken. Okay.
Can't you handle
it? Sorry?
Can't override it manually?
I don't want to do that. These boards cost more than I do. So I'm replaceable. These boards aren't. I'll put in a help ticket afterwards so somebody else can come and have a look at it. So now if you have a function of a complex function, which we write as like that, and we say, okay, we say that the function is differentiable at point z naught if for some small omega has this expansion. So what are all these things? So omega is some complex number. E, the real, is another complex number. E is going, we are going to identify E as the derivative of F. So we say that it's complex differentiable if the mod of the remainder function divided by omega goes to 0 as omega reaches the approaches the origin. So this is our definition of, this is a condition we impose on complex differentiability. Now, because this is a complex equation, we can now break it up into real part and an imaginary part. And then if you compare this to those equations, what we find is that the U part, sorry, it's repeating a lot of things, but it's necessary. And this board likes to shake. Stop. Whereas the V is given. Plus k of alpha. So, according to the definition of real differentiability, alpha is nothing but del u by del x at the position x0 and y0. But it is also the partial derivative of v with respect to y at the same point. And beta is minus of u by y, but it's also v, the partial derivative of v. So complex differentiability imposes conditions on the way that, on the real and the imaginary part, how the derivatives with respect to x and y are connected, right? So these equations are at the heart of complex analysis, and they are known as the Cauchy-Riemann conditions or equations. So to recap, a function is complex differentiable if it is real differentiable. So if it's differentiable as a real function, and if it satisfies the Cauchy-Riemann conditions. Okay. So such functions at that point is called analytic. So this is a analytic at, if it's analytic in a open subset of the complex plane, it's called holomorphic. Some people will use the word analytic for both senses. So, okay.
So you used the word holomorphic earlier about when you said it was to.
Yeah, we'll come to that.
Okay.
Yeah, we'll come to that in a moment. Yeah. So, sorry, you had a comment or question or? Good, I don't like comments or questions. I'm just kidding. So let's get some intuition about this complex differentiability. So in some sense, the complex differentiability, what it does is that it makes functions which are complex differentiable coordinate invariant on the complex plane. And what do I mean by that? So suppose you have a function of complex, a complex function which has u and v, and these functions are real differentiable along the x-axis and the y-axis. That does not mean that the resulting function f, if you differentiate in any other direction, arbitrary direction, other than x and y, that it'll still be differentiable. Okay? If the function satisfies the conditions of complex differentiability, then if I say that the function is complex differentiable at a point, then it's differentiable from any direction. And there's a cute but a little contrived example in the lecture notes, where if you define, say, f a function which is 0 if at the origin, but otherwise then you can show that this function, the partial derivative with respect to x and y are completely well defined. But if you plot the function, you'll see that there are other angles on the complex plane if you approach that the origin that that function is not, it doesn't have well-defined partial derivatives. Okay, it's a little contrived, but it's a good example. So I've already told you how to spot a holomorphic function. So, and here I will show you why that is so. So, you know, starting from, you know, this thing, this definition of Z and Z bar, you can derive by using the chain rule. So the idea is that you're treating Z and Z bar as independent function variables. So if you do this and then do a little bit of algebra, then you can show that the Cauchy-Riemann equations are just the real and imaginary part of this equation. Okay. And that basically means that f is just a function of z and not z bar. Okay. So these are essentially Cauchy-Riemann equations written in terms of Z and Z bar. Okay. Just, you know, break it up and you can see it very easily. Just use this, you know, use the inversion of these relationships.
There. I guess.
Yeah?
What annoys me there is I have no trouble, you know, when you take a derivative, it's you vary in X or in Y, right? And I have no trouble imagining varying X and Y because they're, you know, they're both free. I'm free to put my. On the other hand, when I specify Z, I've fully specified Z bar, so I can't vary them independently.
You can't vary them independently. From that point of view, when you vary Z, your Z bar is fixed, right? Yeah, but there are books where actually this is done properly, where you actually take two different complex planes, and then you define the functions on these two different complex planes, and then you know you do some kind of, you know, you take some cross section of those two things. You know, I can give you reference to those books where
so the practical way to think about it is what you fix one of those and you vary just that.
So
there's no issue with what you said because the extent to which they can't be varied independently is exactly the proportion.
Okay, so I don't see
that, but
you can apply it.
Might it not be easier to just write it out in partial partial derivatives to x and y? Because like those are easy.
Yeah, because x and I mean I have no trouble. Considering x and y as free.
So but just write it out. I mean, you have like there like the condition partial f to z bar is zero. Just write out partial f to z bar.
No, I mean I see his Olivier's problem. Yeah. You know, what he's thinking. Okay, when I think of z, you know, by if I if I think of Z bar as its complex conjugate, then Z bar is fixed.
Yeah.
So varying, you know, Z means that the variation in Z bar is fixed, right? And you know, and he's saying that, you know, that's something that he has problem with, is that to think of Z bar as being an independent variation as, you know.
My point is you can just act as if it's like a mathematical nuisance.
Right.
And just write it out in X's and Y's.
Right, 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 yeah.
And those are intuitive.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, 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 okay, sure. Yeah. But that takes time.
Yeah.
Isn't it also just like a direct? Yeah, no, it's not there.
So it's kind of a game you play with yourself, where you kind of convince. Yeah. All right. We don't have a lot of time left. I want to get to holomorphic conformal maps. Otherwise, we won't get prepared for today's tutorial. So, what are the geometric interpretations of holomorphic functions? So, so if you have a holomorphic function f, and we look at its real and imaginary part, we can define a two-dimensional vector, and then the Cauchy-Riemann. So this is my symbol for a vector. The Cauchy-Riemann equations imply that this two-dimensional vector field is divergenceless, and it's also curl-free. Okay. So very useful for fluids and stuff like that in two dimensions. Another geometric interpretation is which is probably more interesting for us for tomorrow's tutorial. Oh yeah, we have tomorrow, so okay. We don't have to rush. So so given, you know, U and V, you can define a vector field on the two-dimensional XY plane, two vector fields, gradient U and gradient of V, right? And you can check, and the calculation is given in the notes, that these vector fields are orthogonal to each other. Sorry. Where if you take the dot product of these two guys, they're orthogonal to each other. And not only that, the the modulus of these vector fields are the same. Okay? So you can show these things. So in other words, given a holomorphic function, it's U and V, we can construct these two vector fields, and they serve as a basis for curvilinear coordinates on the two-dimensional plane. Right? Because remember, when we have curvilinear coordinates, what we want is that the little vectors are always perpendicular to each other. You know, they can move around, but, you know, and also, you know, they're unit vectors, so, you know, their length doesn't change. So so we can think of the U's and V's, the constant lines of U and V's, as providing kind of a gradient, as a coordinate grid. only your complex plane. Okay. So holomorphic functions also define what are known as conformal or holomorphic maps, and we'll see it in more detail in the tutorial. But the idea is that suppose you have a complex function Z, which is a holomorphic function, which is a function of omega. So you have some omega plane, and Z is a holomorphic function on that. And another function, F, which is defined on the Z plane. Then you can compose functions. So you compose F. F with Z. So you have F Z of omega, and this, when you express it as a function of omega, this is a different function. So the upshot is that given two holomorphic functions, you can generate a third holomorphic function. Right. Now, if our function f of z has real and had real and an imaginary part, u and v, and if g has real and imaginary part, which is capital U, like that. Where I'm not going to bother writing that Z is X plus IY and omega is X plus IY, the capital IY. Then because they're both holomorphic, you see that, you know, these relationships also hold between the U's and V's. So in the tutorial tomorrow, we'll show that these maps, before I say that, let's just like draw a picture. Suppose these were your initial, the constant lines of small u and v. And then after this map, you're taken to some other way of parametrizing the complex plane. But locally, you know, these angles, the angle between these two grids would remain the same. And something that we'll show in the tutorial is that holomorphic functions, when we use them to generating holomorphic maps, they map small triangles to small similar triangles. They will not preserve the area of the triangles, but they will preserve the angles. There is a slight caveat, and we'll also explore that caveat in the tutorial. And these maps, these holomorphic maps that we generate by using holomorphic functions, they have a name called conformal. They're called conformal maps. Or a conformal transformation. And they play a very important role in many branches in physics, such as two-dimensional quantum field theory. They play a central role in string theory. Okay? So the last interpretation of holomorphic functions that I want to mention is that they solve Laplace's equation in 2D. Again, these are all consequences of the Cauchy-Riemann condition or equations. So if U is the real part of a holomorphic function, then you can show very easily that it's a solution of this equation. And Laplace's equation is very important, and in 2D it crops up in two-dimensional electrostatics, two-dimensional gravity, static fluid, steady state fluid dynamics, I should say, and stuff like that. And the amazing thing is that once you've solved this equation for a particular set of boundary condition, you can generate an infinite number of solutions just by using conformal transformations. So it's a very, very powerful tool, right? The other thing is that, that story is not complete because, U is a solution to Laplace's equation. Given the Cauchy-Riemann equation, you can now find V out. The V, which is called the harmonic conjugate. Harmonic conjugate. So by solving Cauchy-Riemann equation, you can find V out, and then you can basically find your function f, right? So all you need is a solution to Laplace's equation in 2D, and you have for free a holomorphic function. And once you have a holomorphic function, you can generate as many solutions to this equation as you want by composing it with other holomorphic functions, given some boundary condition, right? So it's a very, very powerful tool. And this tool is used, for example, to solve steady state aerodynamic problems and stuff like that, airfoil, wind moving around airfoil and stuff like that, I've seen, you can map like a circle to various kind of shapes and things like that. So anyway, this is a very useful tool. All right, I won't be getting to integration of complex variables today. So let me just finish by an example of finding a harmonic conjugate. Suppose you're given some U, which is like this, and you're asked to find its harmonic conjugate. So although it's trivial, and I think it's sometimes, in a mathematics course, it's good to actually do trivial examples. So if you take, so basically what you do is that you take the derivative of U. And then you say that, according to Cauchy-Riemann equation, this thing should be the same thing as dv by dy. And this guy should be the same as minus dv by dx. And then you solve these equations, and that gives you v to be 4y squared, It gives you y4 minus 6x squared y squared plus a function of x, which is your integration constant. And the second equation gives you x4 minus 6x squared y squared plus c2 of y. So if you could, these two can now be combined to find that these, you can identify this guy with this guy, this guy with this guy. Okay. So apparently for complex variables which are functions of more than one, holomorphic functions which are functions of multiple multiple complex functions, using this procedure becomes very, very tiresome and long-winded. There is some shorter process for doing this. And the book that I mentioned that uses Mathematica has this other method. So you can look that up if that's something you need. Okay, so I have 9 more minutes, and maybe I should, let's just introduce the idea of complex integration. So I'll just give you the definition of a contour integral. So often we'll have to consider integrals of this form where you have a holomorphic function integrated over some curve gamma. So gamma is a curve in C that does not intersect itself. Now, such curves are called simple curves or Jordan curves. So a contour is a piecewise smooth simple curve, by which I mean this is a contour if it's a map from some interval of the real line to some open subset of the complex plane. So piecewise smooth means that the curve can be like this, it can be like this, but it cannot be like this. By this I mean that it cannot be a fractal curve. So So in, if we have a curve like this, then we define a contour integral. So this is a definition on such a curve with a holomorphic function z. Because we only know how to do real integrals, right? So we have to define it in terms of real integrals. So it's the integral from A to B. We'll define the integral as part of the, you know, it'll have a real part and a complex part and an imaginary part. So we get the function evaluated on the path. So and suppose t is the parameter which takes the value from A to B. So this is how we define the contour. So now, if you decide that you don't want to use t, you want to use a different parameterization, and if your new parameter is s, but it's related to t in some monotonic way, right? Then you can change, you know, you can. This definition tells you that the right-hand side is parameterization invariant. So to see this, you know, you just use the chain rule over here. You know, this thing is invariant under reparameterization. I should probably put a T here. Yeah. Where this thing, essentially, if you use the chain rule here, you can show that, you know, this thing is also invariant. So, okay. So this way of defining a contour integral is a parameter independent way of defining an integral. Okay. So I have 3 minutes, and let's do a contour integral. Let's do a contour integral of a function around a circle of radius r, centered around the origin. So our contour is going to be r e to the power I t. So t is just a real parameter. So here t goes from 0 to 2 pi. And we want to do the integral of a function which is z to the power n. Right. So according to our definition, we have to do the integral from 0 to 2 pi. Our function is, if we express it in terms of our parameter, is r to the power n e to the power I n t. And then we have to consider this guy, and this guy is I r e to the power I of t, and then we have dt. So this integral only depends on t, so we can bring the r out, so we have r n plus 1. And then we have the familiar integral of 2 pi, which is e to the power I n plus 1 of t of dt. And this is 0 if, well, it's not 0 if this is 2 pi I. If n is minus 1, right, then this becomes just 1, and this is just 2 pi, and the r drops out. But otherwise, it's just an oscillatory function. You're integrating it from 0 to 2 pi. This is 0 otherwise. Right. So this is a very, very simple example. But essentially, every fancy result in complex analysis boils down to this integral. So, okay. All right? Perfect. See you tomorrow.